This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
It's pretty well known that back in the early 1800s, slaves who escaped captivity used a loosely knit group of safe houses called the Underground Railroad to find safety and freedom in the North. But some found themselves looking for freedom in the other direction.
They couldn't navigate, but they had to keep running. And they discovered the next day somehow that they had been running south instead of north.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of a book for grade schoolers, taken from a family's oral history called Go South for Freedom. We'll also learn about efforts to save traditional languages from dying around the country and the world, and spend an academic minute looking for the writing on the wall. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When slaves escaped and ran for freedom in the 1800s, they usually ran north along the Underground Railroad. But a conversation with a family friend one day led Fry Gilliard to seek out the story of a family that got turned around but still found freedom. In his new book, Go South for Freedom, which is aimed at grade and middle school students, Gilliard tells the story of Gilbert Fields, who took his family away from their plantation and found sanctuary with the Seminole Indians of Florida. Fry Gilliard is an author and the writer in residence at the University of South Alabama in Mobile. We spoke about the book, and I asked what brought him to this story.
Well, I was raised in Mobile, and I knew an African-American man. I had known him since I was 4 years old. And he worked as a gardener for my family. And he would ride me around in his wheelbarrow, and he was just the kindest, gentlest soul that I, one of the nicest people that I ever knew. And so he and I remained friends for the rest of his life. He finally died when he was about 94, 95 years old. But one time when I was an adult, I asked him the story of his family, how they had come to be in Mobile. And he told me this remarkable piece of oral history that had been handed down in his family, how his ancestors had run away. They were slaves in somewhere in Georgia, and they had run away in the middle of the night, intending to follow the Big Dipper and the North Star and make their way to the north. But a thunderstorm came up and blotted out the stars, and they couldn't navigate, but they had to keep running. And they discovered the next day somehow that they had been running south instead of north the whole time. And they were filled with despair and didn't know what they were going to do. And they met somehow, just by happenstance, according to the story, another runaway slave who was living in a cave back deep in the woods. And this runaway told them that actually there was an underground railroad that went south, that that slaves ran away to the south all the time. They didn't know this, and I certainly didn't realize it to the extent that it had happened when my friend told me the story. But what the slave told this family they could do was either go and find sanctuary with the Seminole Indians in Florida, or they could find a community of free people of color in a coastal city like Mobile, Alabama. And then my friend Robert Croshan, who told me the story, ended it by saying, and they did both. And that was what he knew. That was the story that had been handed down for 100 years in his family. And it just sounded gripping to me, and I wanted to know more. And I asked him if he would mind if I wrote about it, and he seemed quite pleased by that. And so I began to study the history that went with this oral history, and discovered that, in fact, this was a fairly common pattern, and that black runaway slaves lived often in contiguous villages to the Seminole Indians and fought side by side with them in the Seminole Wars. And I just hadn't known this. It's well documented, but it was new to me. I just was ignorant of this. And so I decided to weave all of this together in a story for young readers, kind of a historical novel with the emphasis on historical. So that's basically the backstory of the book.
What kind of resources did you go to fill in the holes in the story?
There was a lot that had been written about the Seminole Wars, the Seminole Indians, the Black Seminoles. One of the leaders of the Black Seminoles was a remarkable man whose name was John Horse, and he fought as a war chief beside Osceola in the Seminole Wars of the 1830s. Eventually went on the Trail of Tears with the Seminoles, but didn't like it in Oklahoma and led a breakaway band of both blacks and Indians across Texas to find refuge in Mexico. So, you know, I read the historical accounts of that and then found like doctoral dissertations describing how the community of free people of color worked in Mobile and just kind of pulled all that together.
The protagonist of the story is Gilbert Fields. Was that the actual name of the slave?
That was the actual name of the slave, the actual name of the relative, the ancestor of my friend Robert. And I thought it was important to preserve that name. And there are other real historical characters in the story also. Osceola's in there, and John Horse, and Andrew Jackson, and others. But there's fiction woven in. It's the technique of the historical novel that people have done, you know, fairly often for older readers. And this is probably aimed at late elementary through middle school, but I've done programs that included ninth graders, and they seem to get a kick out of it. You know, it's an adventure story, but it's also a story about listening to your own family's stories, you know, about handing things down from one generation to the next, and how important it is for kids to listen to their parents and their grandparents, you know, describe where their own families have been and what may have happened. Because, you know, there are often things that are dramatic or heroic or compelling in the stories of any family. And so that's the other point, I guess, the book tries to make.
Give us an idea of the geography that we're talking about. They came from Georgia South, though I'm assuming they went along the panhandle.
I think they did, yes. That is fuzzy in the oral history. The plantation that they fled from appears to have been in sort of southeast Georgia, because there's a description of the plantation growing rice as well as cotton. But then they would have come across the panhandle and then continued to move south into Florida, because by the 1830s, the Seminoles had begun to retreat deeper and deeper into the Everglades. They did live in the 18-teens, sort of west of St. Augustine and in that area. But after the first Seminole Wars around 1817, 1818 in there, many of them retreated deeper into the Everglades, and that's apparently where these particular runaways, Gilbert and his family, actually met up with them. But again, the specifics of the geography are fuzzy, because it just wasn't the way the story was preserved. But, you know, you can look at where the Seminole reservations are now in the Everglades west of Fort Lauderdale and on up closer towards the Orlando area. And apparently that's some of the area that we're talking about.
They originally set out to go to Savannah.
Right. They wanted to go north. They knew of the Underground Railroad, and, you know, they understood that consisted of, you know, a series of safe houses that you made your way from one to the other to the other. And so they apparently had information about where they could go, and the first stop would have been in Savannah. And that leads me to think, too, that they were, you know, from southeast Georgia, if Savannah was north of where they were living. So, again, one of the reasons that I made it a historical novel is that it's a lot of oral history. There are some parts of it that are very precise, and there are others that are very fuzzy. And the specifics of geography just were not clear after this story was handed down, but the people story was told by my friend with great vividness, as if it had just been told to him. And I wrote the book more or less in his voice, as if he were telling it to a child, because he had at earlier points in his life. So,
and at least he did finally end up in Mobile.
That's correct. That's correct. So, the Gilbert Fields and his family finally ended up in Mobile. And Gilbert, and this is fairly well documented, took a job sweeping floors in a church in an area of Mobile known as Spring Hill, which actually is fairly close to where my family was. And it's the part of Mobile that Robert Crochon himself grew up in. And so when they finally put down roots in Mobile, they put down deep roots and remained in this community, and the family still in Mobile. So, you know, it's a story about the yearning to be free and how deep it runs, and the kind of lengths that people will go to find a chance to live their lives in a full and free kind of way. And the interesting thing about Gilbert Fields was that he was born in Africa, according to the story, and captured and sold into slavery when he was still pretty young, back in the early 1800s, and was brought to this country on a slave ship. And so he still remembered what it felt like to be free and hated slavery all the more because of that.
You talked about the voice of the book, and it was interesting the way you did tell the story. It kind of came off as you were kind of reading an oral history. Why did you aim it for the age group that you did? I mean, you could really write a pretty good novel about this.
Yeah, you know, you could, and I thought about that, but it's funny. The reason I did was because one of my grandchildren had asked me when she was a little girl, 5 years old maybe, if I was ever going to write a book for kids. And that question just stayed in the back of my mind, and I just had Abby in mind as I thought, well, you know, this story could be written any number of ways, but it really could be written for kids. And it seems to work for kids. They do, you know, get hooked on the adventure story. You know, there's a little bit of Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn in it, in a way. I mean, it's that this family wanting to be free, that ground had been covered before with, you know, Jim and Mark Twain or whatever. And again, we see the adventures that can surround this kind of flight to freedom.
As you were researching this, did you find any other stories where you said, okay, there's where I'm going next?
Well, you know, I was fascinated by the whole story of the Black Seminoles. I would love to write more about that. I don't know if I will or not, but it's on my list of possibilities. You know, those story ideas that kind of are like planes circling the airport or something. You know, it's a really intriguing story. You know, there were some Southern Indian tribes that actually owned black slaves. The Seminoles were more inclined to provide sanctuary and to see these folks as allies in the Seminoles' own struggle to remain unconquered. So all of that is so intriguing to me that I'd like to return to that subject at some point.
Again, the name of Fry Gilyard's new book is Go South for Freedom. It's published by New South Books. Still to come, one of the keys to preserving oral histories is preserving the language of the speakers. We'll hear how one speaker is working on that next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Linguists say that by the end of the century, 80% of all world languages will fall out of use. The spread of global languages like English and Spanish has made learning regional languages less useful. But some speakers of these languages are trying to change that. From the series Radioactive, Ben Gold investigates one speaker trying to prevent her language from vanishing.
Linguists say that by the end of the century, 80% of all world languages will fall out of use. The spread of global languages like English and Spanish has made learning regional languages less useful. But some speakers of these languages are trying to change that. Radioactive's Ben Gold investigates one speaker trying to prevent her language from vanishing.
This is Lushootseed. It's a language spoken by many tribes in the Puget Sound region, such as the Muckleshoot and Puyallup. It's been around for hundreds of years, but it's in danger of going extinct. Only a few tribal leaders are fluent in Lushootseed. It's a hard language to learn.
Like, you hear people saying how amazing it is that you can speak it, how they wish they could, but they don't have the time.
This is Maria Martin, a teacher at the Tulalip Montessori School. The school offers classes in Lushootseed to children ages 3 through 5. She worries that the language she loves could disappear.
That's definitely one of my worst fears, is that it dies out and that nobody speaks it anymore, because that's a big part of who we are. And to lose that, it just seems that much easier to lose everything else.
When a language dies, more than just words stop being spoken. Stories stop being told. Songs stop being sung. Preserving cultural values and history is much harder without a way to share them.
How are you going to sing songs you don't know the meanings to? How are you going to provide any traditional connections, like, without the language? I feel you need to know the language, if only some of it, to really understand the whole culture.
She believes if Lushootseed is going to survive, it must carry on in the voices of youth. This is Maria's classroom. Today the children are learning how to count to 10. The lessons in Lushootseed provide a way for the kids to experience their cultural heritage, which they couldn't find in most preschools. Maria says the response from the parents and the community has been overwhelmingly positive.
You'll see video posts on Facebook, and it'll be their kids singing a Lushootseed song, or, you know, telling them some words in Lushootseed. And so you see that pride of the parents that, hey, my child knows this, that's something to be celebrated.
When Maria was a child, she attended the same school. She thinks that her time there has made her more in touch with her culture.
I hope to be the inspiration that some of my teachers were to me when I was growing up. I was lucky enough to start out in Montessori and learn some Lushootseed. But after I left Montessori, I didn't get much exposure. Like, it wasn't offered in school anymore.
Teaching the language in preschool is a good start, but Maria says that much more work needs to be done. The Tulalip tribes are working to train more teachers and get language programs into higher levels of school. But it's going to take more than just that. If the language is going to remain relevant, it must adapt to the changing lifestyles of its speakers.
Technology has changed. Words are now being used, so we're having to create new words for modern life. And in doing so, that's going to help preserve the language.
This is David Cinco. He's not a native tribe member, but he has been working with the Tulalip tribes for the past 10 years as a media developer. Basically, he's in charge of all the technological aspects of the tribes, managing the website, creating weather forecasts in Lushootseed, anything that helps to reconcile the language with the technology of today. For example,
Takad ti suf chislab
means turn off the TV, and
Ha'alik ched ati suf ayil ali
means I am typing on the computer. David is confident that Lushootseed won't be extinct anytime soon.
All the Lushootseed-speaking tribes are really putting a concerted effort, and they are starting to work together more readily. So I see that that is not going to be a problem in the Puget Sound region.
Ultimately, it's up to the next generation to keep Lushootseed alive. After all, that's why Maria does this work.
Show. Bye.
the kids. They inspire me to get up every day to come into work. Next year they might go on to kindergarten and forget all about me. But for that little bit, there was something there. And maybe they'll have the chance to take away what I took away.
For Radioactive, I'm Ben Gold.
When it comes to speaking or telling stories, we've come a long way since we just made markings on the cave walls, right? Well, it could be we just advanced all the way back to that form of storytelling. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How do women stand out in a male-dominated art form? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jessica Babone, assistant professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at SUNY New Paltz, examines the underground culture of graffiti from a feminist perspective.
Hip-hop graffiti writers use Afro-Caribbean aesthetics like call and response and self-naming to assert their voices by relentlessly writing their tag names on public surfaces. Because graffiti writing is a deviant practice that requires physical capacity, the subculture has been characterized as a boys' club, tied to cis male masculine identity formation. So when we see graffiti, we imagine a boy with spray paint in hand, effectively erasing graffiti girls, that's girls with a Z, from the subculture. I've spoken with over 100 girls, aged 18 to 56, across 18 different countries. I've listened to stories from girls who are amongst the first to paint in their cities, like Abby 106 from the USA, Brazil's Prima Donna, South Africa's Motel 7, and Shiro from Japan, as well as girls who look up to those trailblazers. I found that graffiti girls enact a multitude of strategies, on and offline, to resist their erasure. Because these acts create transnational solidarity, foster empowerment, reclaim pleasure, and restore bodily agency in a sexist, male-dominated subculture, I deem them performances of feminism. Despite how these girls have thrived throughout the hip-hop diaspora, their importance to transnational feminist movement has yet to be acknowledged. My research offers a new way of seeing feminism and recognizing feminist movement, one that privileges the subcultural over the mainstream, the deviant over the respectable, the transnational over the Eurocentric, and the intersectional over the essential. Graffiti girls wield spray paint to assert their existence in cities all over the world. Now, we can imagine that.
That was Jessica Babone of SUNY New Paltz. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.